Welcome to Urbanism Vancouver, a podcast that explores how our built environment shapes our everyday lives and community experiences. I'm your host, Helen Loy. Join me as we discover where we live, work, and play, and how we can shape better communities. With each episode, we'll bring a bit of insight and industry experience from myself and my guests. We'll dive into the inner workings of our urban surroundings and explore how places are planned, designed, and built, and discuss ways to create more livable, equitable, and sustainable cities. I hope that you'll learn a little and be inspired to be more curious and more involved in impacting positive change. Before we get started today, we want to acknowledge that this podcast is recorded and produced on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nations. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize the enduring connection they have to this land. We strive to have our conversations contribute towards reconciliation and work towards sustainability and equity for all the custodians of the lands. Welcome to the official start of Season 2, and thank you for joining us on Urbanism Vancouver. As we reflect back on our conversations, we've been positively surprised by the ways the various topics related to each other, and this is a reoccurring theme we hope to explore further this season. With that in mind, today we speak with Rhiannon Fox about the various linkages among better cities, climate action, pedestrian and cyclist safety, as well as community and advocacy.
My name's Rhiannon, and I live with my husband and two kids in East Vancouver. We moved here from the U.S. in 2017 and became Canadian citizens last year, so we can finally vote in Canada at the next election. I'm an environmental scientist by training, and I work full-time for My Sea to Sky, which is an environmental organization based in Squamish, focused on protecting and restoring house sound, particularly from large-scale industrial development. In addition to my paid work, I'm primarily involved with a couple of local organizations. One is One City Vancouver, the Progressive Municipal Party, represented on City Council by Christine Boyle and on School Board by Jennifer Reddy. And then I'm also involved with Vision Zero Vancouver, which is a group that pushes for zero deaths and serious injuries on Metro Vancouver streets. I also do some housing advocacy, mostly calling into city council meetings in support of increased density and climate advocacy, but in a less formal way than my involvement with the other orgs.
I don't know how you have time to do all of those things.
I don't
And, you know, be responsible for all that happens, you know, as a parent in your household. But let's dive into some of those. And perhaps before we do, tell me a bit about how you got interested or started going out and advocating for things. Because I think a lot of people who listen to the podcast might feel like they align with a lot of the things that are being said. But then obviously, like, it feels like a big step to then go out and be part of a group who then goes and advocates for certain things to be changed as it touches upon policy, right?
I've been an environmental activist since I was a kid in various ways and to various degrees. That's why I went to college for environmental science and went on to a master's degree in ecology. And the reasons for that work are pretty straightforward. I want to leave a livable, vibrant, and safe planet, not just for my kids and for everyone else's kids, but for all living creatures. And that's not going to happen without a hell of a lot of work from a lot of people. So my involvement in environmental advocacy has been pretty straightforward. But in terms of other advocacy work, it's sort of taken me some time to find my home in advocacy in Vancouver. I moved around a lot and have been involved in other places as well. But I initially got involved with municipal politics and One City specifically through my climate advocacy work. I think I first spoke to City Council in 2021 on the Climate Emergency Parking Program, which I'm sure you remember was narrowly defeated when Mayor Kennedy Stewart unexpectedly cast his vote against it. I was so disappointed by that vote that I started paying close attention to council. And I have to admit that because I was not a Canadian citizen at that point, I hadn't really been paying any attention to politics, local or otherwise, before that one council meeting. That's sort of how I got engaged there. And then it quickly became clear that One City was really the only party taking local climate action seriously. And then it became clear, too, that they were the most serious voice on other issues that I care a lot about, like social justice and housing affordability and active transportation.
I want to touch on climate action, because in the West Coast, there seems to be like this idea that if you are for climate action and if you are environmentally sensitive, or that if you care about the environment, you must also be opposed to density or urbanization. And clearly, if you're advocating for more housing and more density, then you're an example that that's not always the case. So maybe can you give us like a bit of a rundown or your thoughts as to why those things kind of go hand in hand?
Absolutely. So I'm actually a relative newcomer to housing advocacy. I never really gave it much thought at all until I moved to Vancouver. And even then, for my first few years here, I didn't dig much deeper than doing what everybody else was doing, which was just complaining about the cost of housing. So I got here in kind of a roundabout way because, again, of my interests in climate and also active transportation. As someone who bikes and walks just about everywhere, I was really upset about my constant run-ins with other drivers, with their speed and carelessness. It took me a while, but I gradually came to realize that one reason so many people drive everywhere and are so stressed out and driving so fast is because they don't live near where they work, or where their kids go to school, or where they do their shopping. Because they can't afford to live in Vancouver, there isn't enough housing for them. Certainly, some people do live in the suburbs and commute to Vancouver by choice. Many do it simply because they can't afford to live in Vancouver proper. And that's largely down to availability. We need abundant housing in cities, in places where it's possible to walk, bike, and transit, so that people can live close to the things they care about, get out of their cars, and live more active and less stressful lifestyles. Virtually nobody wants to be spending an hour commuting from Abbotsford. And of course, there's also the issue of urban sprawl. I know that people who are opposed to building more density in the city often talk about the loss of green space in the cities. But it's not as though if we don't build housing for people in the city, they'll just disappear. They have to live somewhere. And if we don't let them live here, what that looks like is more and more subdivisions being built up into the mountains and onto the farmlands and loss of really ecologically valuable green space. Whereas in the city, this is already developed and we can certainly minimize the impact by inviting more people to live here rather than pushing them ever further out. So for me, there is no conflict between housing advocacy and climate advocacy.
What are your thoughts then on type of buildings and construction? Because one thing that we're constantly hearing about is if you densify living in a city, there's also the use of concrete, which I know is very unenvironmentally friendly. It has a huge carbon footprint. How do you kind of square that with that impact versus the benefits you are seeing of limiting urban sprawl?
On the one hand, you have the impact of producing large quantities of concrete. On the other hand, the alternative being people living outside the city, you have urban sprawl, as you mentioned. You have the huge increased use of energy to heat and supply electricity to those homes, whereas those expenditures are much reduced in denser living situations. You have much more vehicle traffic, many more vehicle miles, and all of the infrastructure needed to get people to and from the suburbs. You have road construction, road maintenance, you have to build sewer lines and water lines and everything else out to the suburbs. So while it's true that concrete is not without its flaws in terms of environmental impacts, I believe that it's still more beneficial to build higher density housing in the city than all of the other impacts you see with more dispersed density. And of course, we're seeing more and more mass timber housing being built, and I'd love to see more of that. I'm not a housing expert by any means, or a construction expert. But one reason that we've relied so much on concrete towers is because density is limited to pockets of the city, around SkyTrains stations, along arterial roads. And you can't build, I don't think, you can build a 60-story mass timber building, but you can build a 4 to 6 story mass timber building. And if we allow that sort of construction everywhere in the city, then we won't need to use as much concrete because we won't have to rely so much on the large concrete towers that's currently the only thing we're allowing.
Housing Minister Ravi Kalyan seems like he's working on it, of getting some policy in place to make it a lot easier, but it's still going to be a little ways to go, I feel. So why do you think there is such a fixation on, you know, that if you're green and if you're environmentally friendly, that it means like a single family house with those leafy yards and whatnot? Like, how do we go about shifting some of that approach and perspective when it comes to what cities need to focus on if we are going to be climate friendly?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think so much of the reason that people are opposed to denser housing is, you're right, because they have this dream of a house and a yard and a tree in the front yard. But people with a deeper understanding of ecology and you don't really have to have that deep an understanding, but just a little bit, you realize that most people's lawns are not providing any valuable habitat. What provides valuable habitat is intact ecosystems. So we really need to draw attention to the fact that when everyone is encouraged to buy a single family home, that takes up far more space, obviously. And that means that there is less space left for nature, less space left for intact ecosystems. But I think also we can encourage people to see the benefits of density in cities and better urban environments by building better urban environments. We can incorporate more green space, more parks into cities, and we can do that more easily if we eliminate some of the single family areas of the city to make space for that green space. And I think also a lot of it comes back to cars. I'm sorry, I keep returning to cars, but one of the reasons that people sometimes think of cities as devoid of nature and unpleasant to be in is because you're surrounded by cars. It doesn't have to be that way. We can drastically reduce the number of cars in our cities by providing other options. And that makes a huge impact on the feel of the city. If you go to a city in Europe or in Asia where there's better public transportation and more of an emphasis on active transportation, it's so much quieter. It feels so much more peaceful. It's not cities that are loud, it's cars.
Ree highlights important considerations in the relationship between climate and urban development. We focus heavily on the climate impacts of the materials of construction. However, less attention is given to the impacts of the lifestyles that result from less dense and more sprawled developments. Similarly, our reliance on the personal vehicle creates a correlation between cities with noise and pollution, when the latter should be more closely tied to cars. So how do we build cities that are more for people and less for cars? Ree shares an example by telling us about her household's choice to live a less car-dependent lifestyle.
So I feel like I need to add a caveat here that I was highly car-dependent for most of my life prior to going car-free in 2019. I grew up in a prairie state in the U.S. where I got my driver's license at the ripe age of 14, and I was pretty much a daily driver from then on. But my husband and I spent a few years in Seattle in the mid-2010s, and as a parent of a baby at that time, was really inspired by a member of our babysitting co-op who lugged her kids around in a cargo bike. So when we decided to move to Vancouver in 2017, the first thing I knew was that we were going to buy a cargo bike upon arrival, and that's what we did. So we sold one of our two cars before we moved up, bought a cargo bike in our first month in Vancouver, and sold our remaining car 2 years later when we realized we were using it so infrequently that it didn't make financial sense to hold on to. So our kids were 2 and 4 when we first started using a cargo bike as our primary transportation, and they're 8 and 11 now, and that's still mostly how we get around. You're right that I do live in a pretty low density, low transit accessible area right now. We make it work because we're committed to it, for one thing, and because we are not averse to walking. So we do live on one bus line or a block and a half off a bus line. And we're just under a kilometer from two SkyTrain stations. That's a distance that a lot of people aren't willing to walk, but it's not a barrier for us. And so we do regularly walk to the SkyTrain from where we live. But living car-free has honestly been really great. It's so easy to be car-free in Vancouver, even in parts of town like mine. And I'm honestly a little surprised that more people haven't gone that route. Between pretty decent cycling infrastructure and weather that's conducive to year-round cycling and walking, good public transportation, and two car share programs, it's highly doable for a lot of people. And definitely the car share programs make a big difference. I don't think that we would have been able to commit to it if that weren't an option, because we have family and friends who live down in Washington and we can't bike there. So we do sometimes need a car, and there's always one available when we need one.
What about getting things like groceries? Or sometimes people say, well, I can't get rid of my car because what if I need to go to Home Depot and buy some lumber or something, right? How are you finding being able to do some of those errands where you have to maybe pick up stuff that people are thinking would best be suited for a car?
So when we first went car free, we lived pretty close to Commercial Drive, which was great. So we would just walk to a lot of the independent grocers along there for most of our groceries. We still have groceries pretty close to us. We're two blocks from TNT and a couple of other little shops. So we do a lot of walking to get groceries, but we do most of our big grocery shopping with our cargo bike. Fun fact about Home Depot is that you can rent trucks directly from them when you need to get a load of lumber.
Oh, did not know that.
Yeah. And going back to the car share program, another great thing about Moto is that they have lots of different cars available. When we moved from our last apartment to our current place, we rented a cargo van from Moto. And they also have pickup trucks available and SUVs. Usually for most of our trips, when we need one, we just get their compact cars. So I do see the arguments that you're referencing. People talk about, well, like, what if I need to pick up a load of mulch, or I need to bring home a new flat screen TV? It very rarely makes financial sense to buy a car for occasional trips, especially when you live in a place where cars are available when you need them.
So following the pandemic, have you found an increase in delivery service from different retailers or groceries or restaurants or things like that? And has that kind of shifted maybe some of the reliance on a personal vehicle for some people?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think a lot of larger grocery stores especially started offering grocery delivery services during the pandemic, as well as curbside pickup, which we sometimes do with our cargo bike. Especially if you live closer to downtown, you'll see lots and lots of delivery cyclists. So certainly the options have gotten a lot better since the pandemic in that regard.
You've talked a little bit about climate action and that requiring a little bit more density, a little bit more walkability and cycling in our urban areas. I want to shift a little bit over to some of the work with Vision Zero Vancouver. And this is something that I think for me, it's been a learning curve as well, is like kind of seeing how the cities really right now are designed and prioritizing cars. But I think for a lot of people who grew up in North America, it's really hard to see that unless they've maybe had the benefit of being able to travel to somewhere where a city was built before cars were kind of invented and the main mode of transportation. Could you maybe give us some examples of how our cities are really designed to prioritize the personal vehicle?
So much of the way our cities are designed is really all about efficient and fast vehicle movement. And that is the priority. A prime example of this is that speed limits on Vancouver streets, even fully residential streets, is 50 kilometers an hour, even though we know that that speed is deadly to pedestrians and cyclists. We know that. There's no reason for people to have to drive that speed on residential streets. It just doesn't make sense to have speeds that high in areas where there are lots of people walking and living their lives. So Vision Zero Vancouver formed following the death of a cyclist in downtown Vancouver and the critical injury of a young child in Kitsilano, both at the hands of drivers. Traffic violence is systemic in North America, and in the Metro Vancouver area alone, there are over 500 pedestrians injured or killed by drivers every year. I want my children and all of us to live in a city where we have freedom of movement, where we can travel safely to and from school and work, where we can wait at bus stops without fear of a driver running up on the curb, without constant exposure to the noise and pollution and other health risks of vehicle traffic. And we know what the risk factors are. We know that they're The risk factors are high speed limits, multiple lanes of traffic, slip lanes, which encourage high turning speeds, right turns on red. And because we know what the risk factors are, we know how to fix them. We can't rely on everyone being perfect 100% of the time. We've been asking drivers nicely for years and years and years to please drive carefully, please follow the speed limit. It doesn't work. We have to design our roads taking human error into account if we want to have safe streets and we want to save lives. So I think this is an achievable future, but it really will take some serious reevaluation of our priorities. We can't prioritize speedy vehicle throughput on city streets where people live.
Vision Zero Vancouver is advocating for something that is achievable with sufficient dedication. And I believe that greater awareness is the first step. While a lot of it will require individual action, such as what Ree's household is doing, much of it will also require changes in our policies and the way we design cities. Ree then provides some examples of the initiatives with the greatest positive impact.
My family's been successful at being car-free largely because we're committed to it, but it's not going to be an easy sell for a lot of families with the status quo right now. Some examples of this. If you pull up Google directions from your current location to pretty much any place in the Lower Mainland, unless you and your destination are downtown, the maps will likely tell you that driving is the fastest route. If we want our city to be less car dependent, we need to make options other than driving the fastest, safest, and most comfortable. We know walking isn't the safest travel option because there are 500 pedestrians injured and killed every year. With bike routes where we're constantly having to navigate around parked cars and risk being hit by stop sign running drivers, cycling definitely isn't the most comfortable. And with overcrowded and underscheduled buses, transit is rarely the fastest option. So these are things that we can fix because we know what causes them. We can make driving routes more circuitous and cycling routes more direct, more protected. We can reduce wheel speeds throughout the city. We can change intersection designs so that all road users are safer. We can give buses dedicated lanes on all arterial routes and prioritize shorter walks from bus stops than for parking lots. A great example here is the UBC bus loop, which is at the edge of an enormous campus. And so if you're taking the bus to UBC, you're already likely taking it a long way because there's no housing for students near UBC. And then you might have to walk a kilometer or more from the bus to your classes. Things like this should be really easy to fix. I'd also love to see more government incentivization of non-car options. The provincial e-bike voucher program last year was a good start, but it was pretty inadequate to the demand. I really think that anybody who wants an e-bike or any family who wants a cargo bike should be able to get one, especially if the alternative is for them to drive. If I were in charge, and I'm sure that some of your listeners will be grateful at this point that I'm not, I would roll out a government program where if someone proves that they've sold their vehicle and not replaced it, they'd be given a voucher for a free e-bike, a year's transit pass, and a year's membership to Moto Car Co-op. I think that would do wonders for getting people out of their cars. But we can incentivize developers too. Right now, we require developers to build parking for cars, but we could allow them to substitute car share and bike share programs for a good number of those car parking spaces. I know we're moving in that general direction, but I'd love to see it go a lot further.
People might feel like, okay, that's a great wish list of things that we could do if we were like being idealist of 10 years, 15, 50 years down the road. But for the immediate future, if we were to make traffic go slower, wouldn't that just create more congestion? Wouldn't that create more exhaust? And I guess there's also the equity piece that I'm curious about, because a lot of the people who are currently living further out into some of that possibly sprawl area that you've been talking about are people who couldn't afford to live, you know, close to the things that, you know, to their daily trips because of high housing costs, because of current low density. So they're relying on driving into the city, into their work and whatnot. So if we're creating more congestion and making it harder for them to come into their trips or day jobs, isn't that kind of like an unfair burden onto the people who already have been pushed out because of high costs?
Yeah, I think that is a reasonable concern to have. But neither I nor Vision Zero are calling for banning cars. And I know that a lot of people do rely on their cars. People who live too far away, people with disabilities that don't allow them to walk or cycle, but are still able to drive. A lot of people will still need cars for the foreseeable future. But people who live in the suburbs and are driving into Vancouver for work will not be slowed down significantly if, when they get off the highway in Vancouver, they have to drive 30 kilometers on streets with pedestrians, then 50 kilometers an hour. So average driving speeds in the city are between about 30 to 40 kilometers an hour already, but those are averages. So people are speeding up between traffic lights and slowing down. And in cities where they have dropped the speed limits, average travel time has not significantly increased. So things like that, that's a really simple thing that we could do almost immediately. We could almost overnight drop the speed limit on the default speed limit on city streets to 30 kilometers an hour, because we know that would save lives and it wouldn't inconvenience drivers, not significantly, and certainly not enough to compensate for the lives that are lost due to higher speeds. But I want to address to your point that there's an equity piece because people are forced to live outside the city. This is not an overnight solution, of course, but we do need more housing in cities, more affordable housing, so that people with lower incomes can afford to live in the city and not be forced to drive. Driving is really expensive. Owning a car is very expensive. I don't have the stats on hand right now, but I think that the average Canadian spends about $10,000 a year on their car. That includes car payments, of course, gasoline and insurance costs, maintenance costs. It all adds up. And that is a cost that people who are already struggling are forced to bear. And that is an inequity as well that I think needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I know Vision Zero is something that's implemented in various cities around the world. Is there an example location where it's been implemented and it's kind of created reduction in harms to pedestrians and cyclists?
So there are some great examples from Europe. Oslo in 2019 reached a really impressive milestone in its pursuit of Vision Zero. That was the first year that it actually witnessed zero cyclist and pedestrian fatalities. The way that Oslo reached that milestone was a huge amount of improvement in traffic safety. They built more bike infrastructure. They lowered the default speed limits. They incentivized people to get out of their cars. They installed speed bumps and other traffic calming solutions. Another thing that Oslo did was they created car-free zones around every school in the city because they wanted to focus on child safety in particular. Children are at particularly high risk of traffic violence, largely because they're smaller. They can't be seen as well, and they're more vulnerable to impacts from vehicles. But also because their brains are still developing, children, just like adults, can't be expected to behave perfectly in all situations. I don't know if you know this, but a high school student in Vancouver was critically injured by a driver right outside her high school on a street where the speed limit is 50 kilometers an hour, where there's no crosswalks and no speed bumps. So I think that might be a great place to start, creating areas in the city around schools where we're protecting the most vulnerable among us and the people who have the least decision-making power about how to get around. Our children deserve to be safe.
Rhee's advocacy and passion are important for creating safer and healthier cities. But it is also important to acknowledge that it is not a small amount of time and effort required to engage with policymakers about the way our cities can be improved. Women, and especially so as we age and perhaps start families, face higher barriers to getting involved. I asked Rhee about her thoughts as to how we can make it easier and more accessible for more women to get involved in these conversations.
This is so hard. It's really, really hard. And it is important. And there are ways to improve it, but it's always going to be hard, I think. Especially getting more women involved, because women do bear so much more of the mental load of parenting and running a household. Even though we've made great strides in these arenas, the facts are that women still end up taking on an unfair burden in many, many families. So when my kids were young, I was really privileged to only be working pretty part-time. And so I managed to do a lot of advocacy and volunteering for quite a while. And since I started working full-time, my involvement has dropped off significantly because I just don't have the time or the energy to do as much as I would like to be doing or as much as I was doing before. There are ways to make this type of work more accessible. And some of these lessons we've learned from the pandemic. Meetings can be done over Zoom, and a lot of advocacy work can be done over email. organizations can and should offer multiple ways for people to get involved, because not only do people have different schedules and different demands, they also have different skill sets. I feel like I want to call out municipalities in particular for making the process of getting involved really inaccessible. City council meetings and school board meetings tend to be at times of the day where people just can't physically show up. And luckily, Vancouver, at least, you have the option of calling in. But it's still really hard for people who are working or people who are taking care of young children to show up in those spaces. And so the voices that end up being amplified the most are from the people who have the free time and the privilege to show up at a council meeting and spend 3 hours there in the middle of the day. And I know you know this. And what that looks like often is wealthier folks, older folks, much older, not families, but retired folks largely. And so you see a lot less involvement from people who have more day-to-day commitments. I think one thing that's really important for organizations to consider is how to build a supportive community. Because if people feel like they belong to something bigger and they're supported, then they're more likely to jump in and do the work, even if it's a stretch for them. So this is sort of one of the reasons that I've stayed so involved in One City, because it isn't just advocacy for me. It's also a community of like-minded people, and it's a good social outlet. And so, you know, it's sort of multitasking. I can do this advocacy work and I can also fulfill my social needs, right? And I think a lot of organizations don't do a very good job of that, or don't consider that it's something that they need to address or could address. And they don't consider it as an accessibility concern when it really is or could be. Yeah. So it's definitely a challenge making these spaces work for more people, but making advocacy as inclusive and flexible as possible can go a long way towards getting more people involved and getting more of the really vital community building work that we need to see done.
We touched upon a lot of topics. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Helen, for inviting me. Your podcast has been really wonderful so far, and it's such a gift to the community. You should be really, really proud of the work that you've done.
It is clear that denser cities with fewer cars result in compounding benefits not only for efficient infrastructure, but also for people and the planet. While many of these changes are controlled by policymakers, there is so much we can do within our communities, and RE is a great example of how we can take action in our everyday lives. I hope this conversation might inspire you to explore a different perspective or even a different type of commute. You've been listening to Urbanism Vancouver, the podcast dedicated to bettering our built environment. Be sure to follow us on your listening platform of choice so you don't miss our future releases. I'm Helen Loy. Thanks for listening. This podcast series was independently funded and produced by myself and Aaron Johnson. Visit us at urbanismvancouver.com.